Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everybody. Well, today is Friday. It's February 22nd, 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. Got a fascinating discussion today that's going to take place. And we're going to refer to an open letter written by Austin Mayor Victoria Garrity, Austin Trustee Rick Levin, and Austin Trustee Manuel Quezada. And they published a letter presenting a progressive solution for affordable housing in Austin. And what's fascinating about this whole thing, and we'll get into it, they had a meeting yesterday. They voted on this one way or the other, not sure how. And we're going to discuss the import of what they intended to do. Whether it was successful or not, it's almost indifferent, I think, to even though it will have an effect one way or the other. But I think what's indifferent about it is that it's rare that you find elected officials actually selling a concept, trying to make it an educated principle that is being considered, rather than just simply say, well, I like this and I think this is good, and they don't really fully explain it so that nobody really knows what they're voting for, if they're voting for anything at all, because some people don't even bother because they don't understand it. But what's so interesting about this, which makes it so different, is that here the three officials elected office, and they got together, put their heads together, created a comprehension of what they recognized to be of importance, and then delivered it publicly. We certainly carried their open letter, and it's very compelling. What's compelling is that they are reaching out as opposed to making a decision on their own, and they're including the public, because whether they're knowledgeable or not, whether they agree with them or not, they're including the public so that they can have more than just their 2 cents worth. But I guess the point of a discussion, the discourse, is simply to pose an issue, explain what the issue is, explain its ramifications, good and bad, assuming that it has both, and then try to formulate a concept that will do less harm for everybody, that will have a greater benefit for everyone overall. And that is what was so compelling about this particular letter. Well, I see the mayor is on, so let's bring her in. Good morning, Mayor. How are you?
I'm doing well, Hezzy. How are you today?
I am so excited because it is rare that I get an opportunity to celebrate people in government, especially for what you've done with your compatriots, Rick Levin, who's a trustee, as well as Manuel Quezada. You got together, you formulated an understanding of why you were proposing a certain legislation, and why it's effective, its pertinence, and how it would affect people at present, and also affect property values into the future, and also protect people's prospect for staying in the community that they probably lived in for a great many years. What was the purpose of reaching out to people? Because it's like you're trying to convince them in a very positive way by discourse. That's almost unheard of.
I will say, unfortunately, the ETPA discussion hasn't been a very pleasant exchange at this point. And it's been going on for a while. Mm. And so, certainly there are some people who believe really strongly that it's a good plan because they just believe it. And they've seen it work well in other communities. And I understand that. And the intentions of it are exactly what we're trying to accomplish, which is to preserve affordability in our community primarily. And that's really been the focus of so much of our work in recent years, beginning, we started talking about ECPA again, actively in public meetings in 2016. And then the following year, we did the housing needs assessment. That was our goal. How can we keep our community affordable? But unfortunately, the discussion about ECPA turn into something a little different. And sometimes it got pretty hostile and nasty and not really focused on it as a potential housing policy, just as sort of this lightning rod issue. And so we're trying to turn down the volume a little bit and say, hey, look, we understand it's in place now. A lot of people think this is going to be a really great solution. And it's certainly not all bad. We know it offers a lot of tenant protections and preserves or at least slows down the escalation of rents in our community. Like any policy, it's really complicated, especially a state policy that has been in place for over 40 years and really hasn't evolved very much. So what we tried to do was come up with some sort of a compromise that preserves ETPA for some buildings and offers landlords an option to have more of a people-based solution rather than a building-based solution. And so what I mean by that is the buildings that are in ETPA, they get into that category just because of how old they are and how big they are. That has nothing to do with who actually lives there. So what we've done is we've said for buildings that have 21 or more units where, you know, there's a good number of units that a landlord has to work with, and he probably has a staff that can help him navigate the process with ETPA, or he can choose to join an exempt class of buildings. And exempt classes of buildings are part of the state law that you can create these exempt classes. It usually is just talking about size. That's the most common class that we talk about. So we did exempt the small buildings, which is pretty common among municipalities because there is a lot of bureaucracy to get through, and it's difficult for a small business owner to navigate that process with the state. So we eliminated it for the small buildings. But for the larger buildings, this class we created is that they agree that they will set aside 20% of their units to be part of our Village Affordable Housing Program, but do it at a level where we really have a significant need in our community for affordable units. And that's for people in the 50% area median income level. And when you're talking about that, you're talking about a family of four that is making, you know, less than $58,000 a year. And for four folks in Westchester County, that's really, it's really difficult to find affordable housing at that level. Now, right. Of course, like any compromise, there are a lot of people who are not all that happy about it. So certainly the folks who have been advocates for ETPA with no restrictions, for every possible unit, are not happy. And the landlords of these larger buildings that thought that they were really hoping we were going to repeal ETPA for every building, and then they might voluntarily agree to do some affordable set-asides, but not to this degree, they're unhappy. So maybe we've gotten it just right if everyone's unhappy, or we certainly have a few things to figure out because this approach has never been attempted before. So we're really we're working with affordable and fair housing experts to help us with the implementation of it to make sure that we continue to provide protections for tenants while creating these opportunities for affordable units that will be eligible for people who demonstrate the need, who are at that income level. And then if they're at that income level, they're going to be able to pay just 30% of their income on rent. And that's really what's important, is we want folks to not be rent burdened. And we see so much of that. And that was part of the conversations I was having with the landlords who came to see me during my office hours on Tuesday, who were really unhappy about this. And they said, but yes, we have people who are at that income level living in our apartments now, and they can pay more than that. They'll just figure it out. They'll make it work. What I said was people will figure it out because they need to provide a home for their families. But if they're spending 50 or 60% of their income to be able to cover their rent each month, then they don't have enough money to really be secure and stable at all. And they don't have any money to put it back into our local economy or to send their kids to camp or to have any quality of life that we want for people in our community. And that's what government should be doing. If village government is going to be actively working toward helping have more affordable housing and to be able to preserve a quality of life and equity in our community for people at all income levels, if we truly believe that that is a value for our community, then we need to be promoting programs that address the needs of the people who live in our community. And that, according to our housing needs assessment, is the people at the 50% area median income range.
Speak about this whole issue, and you say that some people are on one side of the equation and others are on the other side. has it been proven anywhere that if this is the concept that you're trying to formulate, does have efficacy, or is there like something that falls off the edge later on after a year or two or five, and it falls apart? Or can this be sustainable? Can the village actually sustain itself financially?
I'm not worried about it affecting the village's ability to sustain itself. And so let me just give a little more context of what we're talking about for the number of buildings that might be impacted. So it's over 1,000 units are currently under ETPA at this size. And I mean, that's nothing compared to, Yonkers and White Plains, but it's far greater than any other village or town in Westchester. And and it's a very large percentage of our overall housing stock. And that's one of the reasons that one of the concerns about having ETPA in Ossining is the impact that it will have on our overall value of our properties in our community, how our overall properties are assessed. And if a large portion of them, if more than 10% of them are going to have their property value decreased over time, then that means everyone else's tax burden is going to be greater to make up for that difference. So part of this effort is to mitigate that. But if we just mitigate that by getting rid of ETPA entirely, then we miss the opportunity to have this leverage to get agreement from some landlords to, instead of ETPA, if they don't want to deal with the state bureaucracy of ETPA and all of the implications and restrictions that come with that, then they have the option to do something in our community that addresses the needs of Ossining residents. And that's by them putting 20%. So if you have 100 units, 20 of your units will now be part of our affordable housing program. And let me just say we have an affordable housing program since 2006. Mm-hmm. When we established our affordable housing policy, we've had a local affordable housing program. So we have some basic structures on what that means for how a landlord needs to conduct themselves. And we audit them to make sure that they are following through with the regulations and all of the tenants who are in these units are qualified, usually by a third party. We're planning to work with we've been in contact with a number of times, our local affordable housing nonprofit who helps us qualify candidates who are at that income level and are going to be able to enjoy having their income, their rent amount reflective of their income level. So most of our units, in fact, our existing program for our affordable housing is at the 80% area median income, which all of these numbers don't mean anything unless you're in affordable housing. But for a family of four, you could earn $95,000 a year at the income level that most of our affordable units are at right now when we're talking about new construction. So it's definitely very different when you're talking about existing construction. And some of the landlords that have come to us, in fact, there's one who's already interested in signing a letter of intent because he's really, financially, it's not going to make that much of a difference to him. He charges low enough rents that having 20% of them, which I think this example is 25 units, let's say, in his building, so five of them would be part of the affordable housing program, the rent for those folks probably wouldn't change. And he probably has residents in his building that are at that income level. And it just means that for them, they can know that as long as they're in this income level, their rent is going to be maintained at only 30% of their income, which means that they're going to have a really decent quality of life. They're no longer going to be rent burdened. And we know that we have units in our community that no matter what happens with the economy or with the continuing skyrocketing of housing costs in Westchester County, that we now will have a good chunk of units that are going to be preserved for folks at low income.
I got to ask you, does some communities in Westchester haven't revalued their properties? And that might be just for homes, but I also understand it's also for some commercial properties. Does that affect in any way the ETPA prospect? I mean, if valuations of property are diminished or increased, that might affect the outcome? And is that going to be affected by reassessment valuations?
Well, you know, we went through a big revaluation in recent years. So during my time as mayor, the process has been happening. Yes, yeah, so Ossining did at the same time that Greenberg did, and yeah, what it means is we're and every year it's not we don't do a full reassessment, but each property maybe it's every 2 years, so we stay at 100% valuation where we were woefully out of date for many years until then. So we do have every year we do have a review of recent sales and what's that done and usually in most neighborhoods gone up a little bit, a couple have stayed the same. So we have a true sense of what our assessed value is, and that doesn't mean that we don't get certiorari claims or small claims asking for people grieving their taxes, and that is definitely happens with independent property owners and with commercial businesses, and that still happens, but it happens a lot less and a lot more less dramatically. Actually, that's been a very helpful process for me as an elected official, because going through that revaluation process has been a learning experience. It's been like going to school and learning about property tax assessments, because there's so many components to it, and going through the revaluation process, all of us in village government and town government got to learn so much more of what happens in those offices of folks looking at property valuations. Yeah,
that's fascinating. So, but what's interesting too is that you have the largest number of units of all villages and municipalities in Westchester County by size, by percentage of population?
More than any village or town. So taking out, you know, White Plains and New Rochelle and just straight up numbers, we have more. So at the moment, we have over 1,500. But after Monday, because our meeting was supposed to be Wednesday, but the snow delayed it, so the vote will now be happening on Monday. We'll take out small buildings, and we'll be left with 1,069. I know at least one of those buildings is going to try and become exempt, and maybe, so it'll take us a little below 1,000. But I believe the next closest is Tarrytown at about 500 units. So even with taking out the small buildings, we're at, let's say, 1,000. So assuming some of those stay in the ETPA program, we still could have more ETPA units than any other town or village. And right now, Mayor, we absolutely do by far.
Well, Mayor, does the fact that you're engaging people in a discussion, does that make them more educated in the discussion, or are they still espousing the emotionalism of it all and aren't getting to facts? Because quite often that's obliterated in discussion or it's just pushed to the side. How do you find the discussions taking place?
Well, it really depends. There are certainly a lot of folks in the community who haven't been at the front lines of advocating for ETPA, but are sensitive to the priorities of wanting to have affordable housing for our community. But maybe I don't know if the longer we talk, the more some people might be open to the understanding the implications of the concerns about having ETPA as it was originally passed, and might be open to the potential value of having a different approach. And then there are, but most people aren't paying that much attention. And so the folks who don't have strong feelings about it, or who are more likely to be maybe resistant to state programs, or, I think there definitely has been an education among a lot of people. It's certainly been an education for many of us in government. It's been pleasant discussion for a lot of folks, because sometimes we seem to be getting away from the focus of this as a housing policy, and it's been presented as a matter of social justice, which having affordable housing and the ability to stay in your home absolutely is. But when it's equated with either you are supportive of ETPA or you do not care about the needs of tenants and poor people in your community, then it's tough for that to, you know, be a foundation for a constructive, thoughtful discussion.
Well, that's what's interesting. There are some people that had contacted me a while back before I even knew you were even discussing this sort of issue, and their biggest concern was that people living in ETPA housing the landlord was not taking care of the building as it at one time had been, and that the landlord was trying to push people out, and that was one of the problems. Does ETPA also make sure that this is the sort of thing that doesn't happen? Or can they
do
that?
One of the best things that, from a tenant's perspective, one of the best things that ETPA does is have very strong tenant protections. It's actually quite difficult to force to an eviction process is really unpleasant and expensive and difficult for all sides. But without what unregulated buildings, which is the majority of buildings that anybody that doesn't have rent stabilization has lots of protections from New York State, and also we have the Landlord-Tenant Relations Council, which can help prevent getting to that point. But ETPA takes that protection to a whole nother level, where there's mandatory leases and mandatory renewals with very few exceptions, and it is a difficult process to evict somebody, which is great if you're a tenant and you're being unfairly targeted. And so absolutely, it is the strongest tenant protections out there is with ETPA, and that's why these conversations are so difficult, because nothing is simple when it comes to housing policy, and that's what we were exploring in our housing needs assessment. And if you read the housing needs assessment, the portion that talks about ETPA talks about so many of the strengths of that program, and yet it recommends that we do not implement it unless and until we have attempted seven other strategies for improving affordability in hand-in-hand with economic development for our community. And I think that's a really strong statement, that even the study that recognizes so many of the strengths of ETPA also recognizes the challenges and at this point said, do not move forward with ETPA unless and until you've tried these other strategies that have less downsides. And what's frustrating to me as the mayor of the village, that is really thinking deeply about how we can do a good job with housing and economic development for our community, is some things like our Senator David Carlucci wrote a letter and had it read out at a public meeting and then appeared on television. And I called him this week and said, Senator, I wish you would stop making public statements telling your local municipality how we should conduct ourselves unless and until you actually are up to date on what's going on in village government, because he was really misinformed. He believed that the housing needs assessment had recommended that we move forward with ETPA. And I said, no, what he was doing was he was only reading the talking points that had been provided for him by proponents of ETPA who were accurately quoting portions of the housing needs assessment, which were identifying the pros. And that's what a good study does. It identifies the pros and cons, but then came up with very specific recommendations. And he seemed oblivious and unaware of that, and was just generally supportive of the state program for rent stabilization, which I certainly understand. It's a state program. And hopefully the state will improve it, because that would benefit a lot of communities throughout our region if they improve it this summer when they have an opportunity to, and we'll see if they do. There's been a lot of politics, a lot of pressure from higher levels of government, both county and state. And what my colleagues and I have said is, we're putting policy over politics. We know this is a lightning rod issue, and it's something that people have have really rallied around. For us, we're looking at housing in a really comprehensive and thoughtful way, and it's beneficial when we have the support and partnership of our leaders and higher government, and we absolutely like to listen and learn from them, but that's not what this feels like. This feels like a lot of political pressure that they're feeling from advocates that they work with, who are their partners in accomplishing progressive policies, which we all benefit from, but without any regard, usually without even reaching out to anybody who disagrees with them in village government, to talk about what are we actually doing about housing, because it's so much more than ETPA. And we're putting ETPA where it belongs in this process, which is part of a bigger conversation about how do we address our local housing needs for affordability.
Needs in the forefront, and housing as a completely different concept, but they're related. People not recognize the importance of one over the other?
Well, I don't think I'd put it that way, because I think we are actually putting people's okay. needs at the forefront. I think people
That's
need
what I
affordability.
Maybe
I think we're a community that people struggle to pay their housing costs, whether they are tenants or they are property owners, and we work very
right.
hard to try and keep taxes low. Unfortunately, we have one of the highest effective tax rates in Westchester County, and that means that if you buy a $300,000 house in Ossining and you buy a $300,000 house in Chappaqua, the Chappaqua tax rate is actually lower. I don't know if you could find a $300,000 house in Chappaqua, but
probably not.
I don't think there are any hovels that small in Chappaqua. So you wouldn't get nearly as much for your house, but your tax rate is actually more dollar for dollar for what you're actually paying for the house. So we work very hard.
Unless it was a butler's house, maybe that was a butler's house.
perhaps. we work very hard to try and keep our community affordable, both for the individual property owners and for the small property owners who may own 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 units and now up to 20 mm-hmm. units. They tend to be mom and pop owners or individuals who own property and are
right.
really working to help contribute to our community, we hope. And if there are landlords mm-hmm. who are bad operators, then we have beefed up and strengthened our Landlord-Tenant Relations Council, and we are getting
right.
the word out that the Landlord-Tenant Relations Council is a resource for folks, and that folks can go right on the Village website and get some help in mediation or addressing the communication with their landlord. And they've 9 months, I believe they had 18 cases that they had worked with and been able to help
mm-hmm.
resolve. And that's really good progress. And getting that information out there more is valuable, whether you're an ETPA building or not. And then we're doing other big things. I think you and I actually mentioned it in the letter you were talking about. Next Wednesday, our work session, I'm so excited. And this is where a good example of where we are working with the county and state, which is
mm-hmm.
to look at development of a village-owned property that will be entirely mixed income and mixed use. So mixed
mm-hmm.
income ranging from people who may earn $35,000 a year to $95,000 a year or even more, because there's some different models that New York State has for helping to finance these kind of really high-quality developments that can be economic catalysts for a neighborhood while addressing
mm-hmm.
our diverse affordable housing needs. And I'm very, very pleased to have the support of Village, County, and state officials, and regionally from folks in the affordable and fair housing world, to be able to provide this kind of opportunity in Ossining. And that's part of the big picture of how we're looking to provide good quality affordable housing in our community.
So do people realize that there are state regulations that actually protect the tenant as well as the landlord? There's got to be a relationship there. Is that statewide, or is that specific to Ossining?
Well, I mean, the state does have a lot of protections in it for tenants, and one of the big challenges
right.
is education of tenants. And part of the mission of Landlord-Tenant Relations Council is to do that. But then also we have created the Safe Housing Community Partners, which is just a, sort of an ad hoc alliance between the Village
mm-hmm.
and some local trusted sources, nonprofits that are part of the community. I'm talking about places like Open Door and IFCA, which is our affordable housing program, and Neighbors Link. And they have been working on putting together what's essentially more or less like a POM card, providing information for tenants, basic protections, and how they can get more information. And having a robust campaign and outreach of that nature is part of our ongoing efforts to help protect tenants and to empower them, for them to know what
mm-hmm.
their rights are. so that they don't find themselves in unsafe conditions. And moving forward with that on all fronts and taking advantage of all our community relationships and partnerships is essential for being able to protect tenants and have good quality housing in our community.
Oh, it sounds so compelling. It's so exciting, actually. But I, you know, I'm sure it's tough on you when you guys are out there, you know, slugging away, especially to those that are ignorant of what's going on and are just well enough educated. Is this a unique process that you're going through for the first time, or is that something that always is part of the demeanor of government and governance?
Well, I think government is always challenged to try and get through really wonky, boring policy and not lose the community's interest on things and hopefully not have things misinterpreted. The particular approach that we're taking by creating a class of buildings that is exempt from the state ETPA regulations by the nature of its affordable set-aside, that's the first time that particular class has been established. And I'm sure it will be challenged. And before we established it, that was our legal question was, if we do this, is it going to withstand scrutiny? And fortunately, there is enough case law and opinions from the past attorneys general that we are confident that it's going to withstand challenge. But, you know, we're already being sued and we're going to be sued no matter what we did with ETPA. So we decided we would do what we felt was best for our community. So we'll see how that pans out. And we've got, you know, a lot of irons in the fire. We've talked about some of them today. One we didn't talk about was the very first law we talked about this year, Local Law 1 for 2019, was can we establish some kind of a lease for all tenants, regardless of where they live? And how do we do that in a way that is consistent with New York state law? And at its foundation is providing tenants with exactly what we were talking about before, for them to know what their rights are and for landlords to know what their obligations are and empowering tenants to be able to advocate for themselves and for them to know that the resources are there to support them and to support them having safe, predictable stability in their homes.
That's going to be the heaviest lifting of all, isn't it? To tell the consumer what their rights are and also what the responsibilities are of the people that have influence over what they want to do in their lives, such as landlords and government. That's the hardest part of all. Well, I don't know. You must be having your Wheaties every morning or something like that to have the strength to just keep on going. It sounds good.
It's always great talking with you, Hezzy. And I know we're going to talk again soon. I'm looking forward to our next screening, which is for Women's History Month. We've got She's Beautiful When She's Angry and three terrific panelists. And I believe I have one lined up already. I'll get you the information about her. It's going to be a really great conversation next month. And there's all
great.
Kinds of crazy stuff happening on the political front, too. So we'll talk about that next time we chat.
That will be really good because there's so much going on, to say the least. And, of course, that problem with natural gas and Con Ed. And, oh, my God, it just doesn't
You're
stop.
Not kidding. You're absolutely right on that one. All right. Good talking
All
with
the best.
You, Hezzy.
Have a great weekend. Thank you, Mitch.
Bye-bye.
Appreciate it. Goodbye. Well, there we have it, folks. What a compelling and captivating speaker, Austining Mayor Victoria Garrity. And today we were talking about the open letter that she and Austining Trustee Rick Levin, as well as Austining Trustee Manuel Quezada, had presented. And if you have an interest, and I can't imagine why one wouldn't, it's not a most difficult read. It's certainly quite simple, but it explains ETPA and the discussion, the public discussion that these three people have engaged the citizenry of the village. And very, very interesting. You could read about it just simply, you know what, if you go to Yonkers Tribune and just write an open letter in our search engine, you should be able to find it. Or maybe in a regular search engine, an open letter by Austining Mayor Victoria Garrity. And I think the others, Austining Trustee Rick Levin and Austining Trustee Manuel Quezada, will come up automatically. So it's something that you might find very, very interesting as well. And then, of course, you can always listen into this particular segment of the Westchester on the Level broadcast. Well, let's take a quick look, find out what's going on in our neck of the woods. First, let's find out what they're doing at the Cabot Creamery, and then we'll be back.
Hey, you a judge?
Well, sorta. I report on cheese. I don't judge.
Well, I heard on the radio Cabot Cheddar always wins awards for taste.
Well, let me see my notes. Best taste? Check. Best texture? Check. The farm families in Cabot, Vermont have won every major award in the cheese world.
Every award?
Every.
What about the U.S. Cheese Championships?
Cabot's won that many times.
How about the American Cheese Society Contest?
Cabot won it.
World Cheese Championship Award?
Best in class on cheddar.
Fiery Food Challenge.
Cabot.
International Fancy Food Show.
Cabot Rules.
The Stanley Cup.
That's hockey.
Oh.
Look, Cabot's won awards for best sharp, best light, best butter, and best cheddar.
Yeah, but a certain big cheese company's TV ad show, they won an award from judges wearing bright yellow lab coats.
Well, those are actors.
Not real judges?
Real judges wear white lab coats.
They do?
Look, Cabot is best because they own the company, ship the milk, make the cheese. They won so many times, the real judges even asked one of Cabot's cheesemakers to be a judge.
I don't believe you.
Here, taste.
Hey, I can taste why Cabot's won every award.
You be the judge.
And I get to wear a yellow lab coat.
White lab coat. Check.
The best tasting cheddar on the planet is...
Time and time again.
Cabot Cheddar.
Check.
Welcome back. Well, evidently Venezuela's Maduro has closed the Brazilian border with Venezuela as Guaido is set out to pick up aid. Very, very compelling. It seems that President Nicolas Maduro ordered the closure of Venezuela's border with Brazil yesterday in an increasingly fraught power struggle with Juan Guaido, the opposition leader spearheading efforts to bring humanitarian aid into the country. Guaido set out in a convoy of vehicles to personally pick up U.S. aid being stockpiled on the other side of the Colombian border, defying Maduro's military to stop him. Recognized as interim president by more than 50 countries, he left the capital of Caracas for the Colombian border in a convoy of several vehicles for the 900 kilometers, that's about 560-mile long trip. Embattled Maduro has dismissed Guaido's humanitarian caravan as a, quote, cheap show, end quote, and slammed aid as a precursor for a U.S. military intervention in the oil-rich but crippled Latin American country. The 35-year-old leader of the Venezuelan legislature proclaimed himself acting president on January 23rd and wants to oust Maduro, set up a transitional government, and hold new elections. A separate caravan of buses and trucks containing opposition lawmakers had earlier left eastern Caracas bound for the border. Several of the trucks were stopped by security forces and their drivers forced to get out, but the rest of the caravan was allowed to continue, lawmakers said. We know that the regime is going to put all obstacles to prevent us from reaching the border, but nothing is stopping us. We are going to continue, said opposition lawmaker Yanet Fermin. Guaido scored important symbolic boosts on Thursday as 11 Venezuelan diplomats based in the United States declared their support for him. Hugo Carvajal, former military intelligence chief to Hugo Chavez, also recognized the opposition leader and called upon the armed forces to break into Maduro. Signaling his growing disquiet, Maduro announced on Thursday that the border with Brazil, which along with Colombia is one of the main potential avenues for aid delivery, would be completely and absolutely closed from 8 o'clock in the evening on local time until further notice. Maria Teresa Balandria, Guaido's designated ambassador in Brazil, had said that aid deliveries would go ahead nonetheless. The operation goes on. There's no going back, Belandria told Agence France-Presse, the news agency. She said that 100 tons of food, medicines, and emergency kits were waiting to be trucked from Boa Vista to Pacaraimo on the Venezuelan border. Maduro also warned on Thursday he was considering a total closure of the border with Colombia to Venezuela's west. He has already ordered the military to barricade a major border bridge to prevent supplies from entering the country from Cucuta in Colombia, where tons of humanitarian aid are being stockpiled, most of it from the United States. Meanwhile, Maduro, mirroring Guaido's move in an attempt to show his socialist government was able to look after its people ordered a shipment of thousands of food boxes to be distributed to the needy along the Colombian border. He also announced on Thursday the arrival of another 7.5 tons of medicine and medical supplies from Russia. Shipments of food and medicine for this crisis-stricken population have become a key focus of the power struggle between Maduro and Guaido. Guaido, who says 300,000 people could die without an influx of aid, says he aims to rally 1 million volunteers to start bringing it in by Saturday. It remained unclear how he proposed to do so if the blockade continues, but expert porous 1,360-mile border, which is perforated by well-worn drug trafficking and contraband routes. Guaido said the planned entry points for aid were the Brazilian and Colombian borders, the island of Curaçao, and the seaports of Puerto Cabello and La Guaira. Venezuela's Vice President Delcy Rodriguez said the government was shutting down air and sea links between Curaçao and Venezuela. However, Carlos Faria, one of the leaders of a group of Venezuelans organizing aid shipments via Curaçao, told Agence France-Presse a plane carrying 50 tons of food and medicine was expected from Miami on Thursday and would be loaded onto a Venezuela-bound ship on Friday. That's today. Underlying the swell of international support for Guaido, British entrepreneur Richard Branson plans to hold a pro-aid concert just inside Colombia on Friday, that's today, while Maduro's government stages a rival concert on its side of the border around 1,000 feet away. It's about 300 meters away. Meanwhile, the White House said Vice President Mike Pence would visit neighboring Colombia on Monday in a show of support for Guaido. The U.S. has repeatedly said, quote, all options, end quote, including military, are on the table. But Brazilian Vice President Hamilton Mourão discussed U.S. threats of military intervention in Venezuela as premature and said it, quote, wouldn't make sense, end quote. I think they're more in the realm of rhetoric than action, Mourão had said of the threats in an interview with Agence France-Presse. Very, very compelling circumstance that is there. And let's hope Maduro will not resort to bloodshed. That's for sure. Okay, so let's quickly look to see. I think that's the biggest story here in the Americas. And then this is interesting as well. The Empire actor staged a Chicago hate crime to get higher pay, is what the police are saying. Actor Juicy Smollett paid two brothers to stage a racist and homophobic attack on him and pose as supporters of President Donald Trump because he was unhappy with his pay on the hip-hop TV drama called Empire. Chicago's police chief said that on Thursday. Smollett, who is black and openly gay, was arrested on Thursday and charged with lying to police about the supposed attack on January 29. Chicago Police Superintendent Eddie Johnson was visibly angered as he condemned Smollett's actions. Police did not spell out how the 36-year-old actor hoped to boost his salary by staging such a hoax. Smollett took advantage of the pain and anger of racism to promote his career, Johnson told a news conference, adding that the actor paid the brothers $3,500 to stage a supposed hate crime. This stunt was orchestrated by Smollett because he was dissatisfied with his salary. He concocted a story about being attacked, Johnson said. We gave him the benefit of the doubt. Police did not say how much Smollett is paid for his role on Empire. If convicted, he could face a prison sentence of 1 to 2-3 years. A judge set bail at $100,000 and ordered Smollett to surrender his passport. The actor, who turned himself in early on Thursday, was referred released from jail after paying a 10% of the bail amount to be stipulated by the judge. In court, Smollett wore a black jacket and stared at the prosecutors as she detailed the religious against him. And so that's the circumstance that's happening there. Very, very compelling as well. And let's quickly go over to see what's happening in the Middle East. And dozens of trucks evidently are evacuating civilians from the last Islamic State group holdout in Syria. So let's just quickly look at this. It seems that U.S.-backed fighters trucked out civilians from the last speck of the Islamic State group's dying caliphate in Syria on Friday, that's today, eager to press on with the dragging battle to crush the jihadists. Now, more than 4 years later, after Islamic State overran large parts of Syria and neighboring Iraq and declared a caliphate, they have lost all of it but a tiny patch in the village of Bahuz near the Iraqi border. Almost 50 trucks carrying men, women, and children left the enclave on Friday. That's what Agence France-Presse correspondents at a position of the U.S.-backed Syrian Democratic Forces outside the village reported. Now, most were women and children, their clothes caked in dust, but the passengers also included men with their faces wrapped in checkered scarves. Women clung to the railings of the trucks while the hair of young girls flew in the wind as they left the enclave in the second such large-scale evacuation in 3 years. And so I think that's the story there. Let me just quickly look to see if there is anything else that's happening in Europe. And then if not, we're going to just move on. And this was really interesting because this is the aftermath of some of the stuff that's happening with regard to the Pope. It seems the Pope has vowed, quote, justice, end quote, to sex abuse victims at a crisis conference. Pope Francis promised that concrete actions against child sexual abuse by priests would result from a conference he opened on Thursday in the Vatican, with one cardinal acknowledging that the church had to fight the enemy within. Francis convened Catholic leaders from around the world for the four-day meeting to address the scandal that has ravaged the church's credibility in the United States, where it has paid billions of dollars in settlements, Ireland, Chile, Australia, and elsewhere among the other three decades. And over the last three decades, his opening remark appeared aimed at countering skepticism among victims who said the meeting looked like a public relations contest. So there, so not much more than what we already know. We'll find out. Just find out what's happening. And then let me quickly go over to Asia just to see if anything has come up. Bear with me. First, let me go to Asia. Then we'll do some business if there's anything. Well, this is really quite interesting because a Japanese probe has successfully touched down on an asteroid, so it's going to be very compelling as more information comes out about it. And evidently dozens of people were killed by fire in Bangladesh, the Bangladeshi capital of Dhaka. So that's something to recognize, that's for sure. Now let me quickly look, and seems as a death toll from a fire in a centuries-old area of the Bangladesh capital of Dhaka jumped dramatically to 70 on Thursday, a fire official said, and could keep climbing as firefighters combed wreckage of the mystery building. My goodness, very, very overwhelming news, that's for sure. Now, let me quickly look one more second. And I wanted to just check one moment here. I wanted to check to see what was happening. Bear with me. Oh, yes, here it is. We were just going to check the stock market, but evidently the big story is still the UBS record $3.7 billion for tax fraud. So that's going to be enough for us today. So I want to thank you again for being with us. What a pleasure, as always. And hopefully you'll have a great weekend. The weather is quite warm in the mid-40s. It should be a lot of fun. Just take care of yourself and enjoy the weekend. And we'll speak to you on Monday. Thank you. Goodbye. Just make sure. I think we signed out. Maybe not.